Hi, this is Andrew, and this is Keen On, the daily now.tv chat show with some of the world's leading thinkers and writers. Hello, everybody. It is Friday, April the 19th, 2024. As much as America might like to forget about the rest of the world isn't forgetting about America or hasn't really calmed down. The headlines today are all about the Israeli missile attack apparently today on Iran. Meanwhile, Israel's denying, I think, a big scale retaliatory attack. It's still unclear whether this is going to trigger a more major conflagration in the Middle East. And in America, domestic politics and international politics are always bound up. The Israel-Ukraine aid bill cleared a critical hurdle in the House. It seems as if America is very ambivalent about the world. On the one hand, it wants to, of course, remain the dominant world power. On the other hand, they probably don't want to pay for it and don't want to be continually reminded of all the chaos in the world. One man who has been watching the world from America is my guest today, Elliot Ackerman. He's a remarkable man, not just a soldier, but a writer and thinker and philosopher. He was on back in 2022 on the show talking about the American so-called retreat from Afghanistan, how it represents the final act of a classic five-part tragedy. And that was taken from a book he had out in 2022, The Fifth Act. He's also a novelist. He was on the show talking about some of his novels, one called Halcyon, which imagined an alternative history of the early 21st century America. And he's back now with an interesting piece in the current issue of Liberties on mercenaries. Fascinating piece we're going to get to later. Elliot is joining us from 72nd Street in New York City. Elliot, is the in this piece, Mercenaries, which we're going to get into, you talk about a Pax Romana, a Pax Britannica, a Pax Americana. Is the current Pax Americana unraveling in the Middle East? Is that what makes sense of all the chaos there at the moment?
Well, I think that, what we see isn't necessarily that the Pax Americana is unraveling in the Middle East, but more we're living through a period, whether it's in the Middle East or in Ukraine or even in Afghanistan, we're seeing that the world order as it existed post-1945 and then certainly post the end of the Cold War is being challenged in a way that is probably as profound as we've seen in decades. And so there are an axis of nations, China, Iran, Russia, North Korea, who are not happy with the status quo. And they want to see a realignment of global power in which they are more central. And the result of that conflict and struggle is, as we're seeing, lots of chaos in the world.
You didn't call this axis an axis of evil. Once upon a time, it was called that. Is this an inevitable feature of great power politics? I was taught international politics many years ago by Ken Waltz, the father of realist IR, who suggested that the nature of things lends itself to great powers challenging one another. There's no such thing as a vacuum of power. Is the American age in this sense coming to an end, with the challenges from Iran and China and Russia and North Korea?
You know, really since the unraveling of the Soviet Union in the early 1990s, we've lived more or less in a unipolar world. And I think it's become very clear, particularly in the last 5 years, that we no longer live in a unipolar world. We live in a multipolar world. And so we're seeing the return of great power competition. Now, if we look back through the course of history, great power competition has often been the norm. But You know, we're coming out of almost, you know, sort of 30 years where that didn't exist. And, you know, America fought its wars in the Middle East, but these were not wars that were existential to the survival of the United States necessarily. And so we lived in sort of a Pax Americana. But, you know, any Pax Imperia is not really peace. It's sort of the illusion of peace through the outsourcing of our wars.
What does this tell us more broadly? Your latest book, which you co-authored with Admiral James Stavridis, is 2054, Imagining the Future of America. Is this unraveling going to continue, Elliot?
Well, I think, you know, if we look at the host of foreign policy challenges and national security challenges that face the United States today, I would certainly say that top among those lists of challenges is our own domestic dysfunction. And we're seeing that play out right now, for instance, you know, with the Ukraine aid passage in the House. Our adversaries know that in the United States, our House is not in order, and they're taking advantage of that disorder to sow discontent throughout the world. So in 2054, it's the second part of a trilogy, actually, the first book, 2034, in that trilogy, Imagined a War with China. This book imagines civil conflict in the U.S. and also the impact that artificial intelligence is going to have on our democracy. So, you know, we're living in an age of, you know, really profound challenges, and how we navigate those, you know, is messy. And we're seeing that play out in the headlines.
It's interesting you bring up theoretical civil war. I'm not sure if you've seen Alex Garland's new movie, Civil War. I did a show with Stephen Marsh, who's the author of The Next American Civil War, this week. Are you yourself fearful of potential imminent civil war in the United States?
I'm not fearful of imminent civil war, although I think it's important to engage with the subject matter of our own domestic dysfunction as a palliative to avoiding, you know, either civil war or types of civil conflict that are extremely dangerous for the country, particularly in an atmosphere like we have today, where the United States since 2016 has sort of veered from one contested election to the next, with the level of contestation only escalating. And now we're going into this fall, yet another presidential election that it would seem will likely in some shape or form be contested. So I think it's important to tell these stories and engage with the issue of civil conflict in the U.S. really as a way to avoid it. And like in 2054 and in 2034 before it, you know, Jim Stavridis and I, you know, we're telling these stories, not because we're trying to necessarily predict the future, but because these are cautionary tales that by imagining this dark future, that actually becomes the best way to avoid it.
How would you like foreign policy in the upcoming election to be debated? I'm not sure whether Donald Trump and Joe Biden are capable of debating anything. It seems in some ways Biden is following Trump, certainly with respect to China. In other ways, he remains a globalist. Would you like to see American foreign policy and Americans' relations with the world become one of the central issues in the upcoming election?
Well, I think our foreign policy always has to be a central issue in any election, but I'm old enough to remember a time when the tenor of our politics in this country was quite different. That didn't mean we didn't disagree and didn't mean there weren't profound levels of disagreement, but the way we disagreed was quite profoundly different. And there was this sort of idea and frankly norm in American politics that our disagreements ended at our shores. And when it came to the projection of U.S. military power abroad, at least at the policy level, that, you know, more or less Republicans and Democrats would get on the same sheet of music so we could have a coherent foreign policy. And increasingly, we have really two foreign policies as a nation. We have a Republican foreign policy and a Democratic foreign policy. And I don't know if that's in the best interests of the country as a whole. So I think that we should be debating these issues, but there has to come a certain point where national policy is set and we as Americans come together to enact those policies abroad. That doesn't mean there won't be dissent, there always will be, but we have to find out a way to dissent in more productive ways. We used to be okay at doing that, and I think we've gotten pretty bad at it in recent years.
As a former soldier, as a guy who's been on the ground, who understands the grisly, tragic nature of war, and I guess also the heroic, thrilling quality of it, Are you comfortable with both Trump and Biden talking about America being great? Trump's always going on about make America great again. Biden seems to be suggesting that America is great. It doesn't need to be made great again. Is that a good word to associate with America?
Well, I mean, I don't have the word great, but I think there is, you know, I don't think nationalism is, you know, necessarily a dirty word in all of its context. I think, you know, it's good for nations to have a strong sense of national identity, to have an understanding of their broader values, or at least a baseline, a sense of values that the entire country can agree on. And I think most countries, and particularly the United States, should be, you know, extremely judicious when we get involved overseas, whether it's in wars or any type of intervention, based off of our values. I think we can look back at our history and see there are times where the U.S. Stepped onto the world stage to project its values in ways that were very positive. I mean, obviously, you know, the prime example is the Second World War, but I think we can point to a host of 20th century examples and now 21st century examples where the U.S. stepped on the stage, tried to project its values, and it was a disaster for the country. There's an absolute answer here. It's one in which our leaders have to look and make tough judgment calls about what role the United States should have in the world.
Ever the diplomat, Elliot. Maybe you missed your calling. Rather than a soldier, you should have been a diplomat.
Well, I don't know if I'm being a diplomatic. That's my answer.
Well, a soldier's response to that. I want to get to your piece on mercenaries in a second. But final question on foreign policy and these broader structural issues. American intellectuals tend to be somewhat masochistic about their country, always thinking it's in crisis and no one takes it very seriously overseas. You're a guy who travels a lot, who understands America, but also understands the world. Is stock in America, is it a particularly low point in terms of how the rest of the world, not just American enemies, but also its supposed friends, look at this country in 2024?
I think a certain degree of sort of existential angst is actually kind of fundamental to the American character. We always have this anxiety that we are in decline. This is not the first time in 2024 we believe we were in decline. You could look at, like, you know, the late 1970s, early 1980s, we felt we were in decline. You go to Vietnam, we certainly felt like we were in decline. So this moment is not unique, and America kind of wringing its hands and predicting its imminent decline is also not necessarily unique. I mean, that being said, our challenges are real, and we have to figure out a way to navigate through them. But I do think, you know, it is very American to be sort of worrying and fretting about the state of America's imminent decline.
Well, let's get to your wonderful new piece in Liberties, Mercenaries, which also got adapted for the Washington Post with the title, What It Means When the Mercenaries Appear. You cover a lot of ground in a short piece. You talk about Britain, India, Vietnam, Afghanistan, Ukraine. But in terms of what it means when the mercenaries appear, does it mean, Elliot, decline?
Well, it can often mean decline. And, you know, it's not just the mercenaries, but it's really this larger idea of what does it mean when societies, and particularly democratic societies, begin outsourcing military service to groups that are outside the core citizen base. So when a society stops being one that has armies of citizen soldiers and starts being one that has armies of professionals and mercenaries. And oftentimes that outsourcing is a good indicator of what I would call late empire behavior.
Tell me a little bit about the narrative. As I said, it's a wonderful piece, and everyone needs to become a subscriber to Liberties. They're a sponsor of the show, so I would say that, but it's a particularly wonderful issue, this one. What are you arguing ties together the East India Company and Afghanistan, Iraq, and indeed contemporary Russian involvement in Ukraine?
You know, if we take a look through history, you know, we go back and we look, and in the piece, I sort of begin with the Romans. You know, one of the great indicators of the decline of Rome's empire was the moment in which they started outsourcing their military service to legionnaires who were not from Rome. So for many decades, they had their legionnaires recruited from amongst the citizenry inside of Rome. But then as the empire expanded, those legionnaires began coming from outside of Rome, from provinces like Gaul and Spain and otherwise. So it got to the point in Rome where legionnaires didn't even speak Latin anymore. They spoke, they spoke languages outside of the Roman language. And ultimately, when it came to the decline of Rome, it was due in part to the fact that the legions crumbled from within. And so when we project this forward, we can see in Britain, a nation that at the height of its imperial power in the 19th century, which was, very much fascinated with the Roman Empire, what they did was adopt many of the programs that that the Romans had used, to include a reliance on indigenous troops, like in the East India Company and the sepoys, as a way to basically increase the numbers of their army. So there too, you see the outsourcing of military service. And then in the piece, I sort of bring it up to the modern age in the United States, and the way that, the American Army, which, for quite some time, back to the legacy of the Minutemen, or the national mobilization that occurred in World War II, or the decades afterwards when we have a draft, was very much a citizen army. But really post-Vietnam, we become a professional military. And increasingly in the 21st century, during the War on Terror, it becomes a military that, although we have an outsourced military service to a separate group of people like the Spaniards or the Germans in our empire, we've outsourced it to sort of a subculture within U.S. society, which is this military subculture. And and what are the dangers of that? And I think if we look back through history in the U.S., the founding fathers were very skeptical of large standing militaries. And I think they were right to be skeptical, because a read of history teaches you that whether it's from, Napoleon's Rome, Caesar's Rome or Napoleon's France, what you see is that when you combine a large standing military and domestic politics that are very dysfunctional, democracy doesn't last long. And those are sort of the conditions that exist in the U.S. today.
One president who comes out well of, I thought of your piece, was JFK. Does he represent, with his commitment to service and his vision, even of America in the Cold War, is he the model for what America might return to in terms of the importance he places on national service and indeed on the military?
I don't know if it's JFK specifically. I mean, I mentioned in the piece Kennedy, because Kennedy was sort of one of the, he really was the first president to understand, actually, that indigenous forces, special operations forces, fighting, by, with, and through their indigenous partners, could be a great tool of American power projection. So, a 15-man team of Green Berets could advise a 1,000-man battalion of Montagnards in Vietnam or Afghan commandos in Afghanistan. So you have a much, you have a low American presence, but you actually get a multiplier of the troops that are actually on the battlefield for you. So Kennedy is the one who understood this strategically and really kind of put the U.S. on the path of working by, with, and through indigenous forces in a way that extends to this day. There's a lot of good and a lot of bad that comes with that.
Yeah. So I think I may have got that question wrong. So you're arguing that sort of the seeds of Kennedy's, and of course, many of the seeds of the Vietnam War can be traced back to JFK, that the seeds of quote unquote Vietnamese mercenaries in the Vietnam War can be attributed to JFK himself.
Right. And the word mercenary is very broad. I mean, you know, it's a broad term. I mean, it's really this idea of outsourcing service, taking service, which, you know, at the closest the military service can be to the state is the citizen soldier. You know, the soldier who votes, the soldier who's not a professional, who has been uprooted from his or her job to go serve in a conflict. But then, you know, we can start outsourcing to professional soldiers who are still citizens, or to indigenous soldiers who are, you know, fighting for a foreign government, but that foreign government is aligned with our interests. And it's really this idea of, you know, the perpetual outsourcing of service up to and including actual mercenaries, that is in some way indicative of the state's desire to reduce the political cost of a war. Because the most costly way to fight a war is with citizen soldiers, because after a year or two, you know, their families and they are going to start, you know, you're going to start hearing from them if the war is not going well or coming to a conclusion. Whereas indigenous troops and mercenaries will fight for a much longer time and a much lower political cost.
Again, the piece with reference to Afghanistan. As I said, you're the author of The Fifth Act, America's End in Afghanistan. You contrast the withdrawal of some mercenary soldiers from some quote unquote, I guess, real soldiers. I don't know what the opposite of mercenary is. How central is this issue of mercenaries in the various tragic farces, American tragic farces in Afghanistan, and indeed the Soviet one as well? Was the Soviet invasion of, you don't talk about this, I don't think, in the piece, but was the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan another catastrophe, of course? Was that partly engaged with mercenaries? Of course, one assumes that Afghan resistance to all invaders, whether they're Soviet or American, is conducted by anything but mercenaries.
Well, I think when we look, you know, when we look at the Soviet invasion in Afghanistan and the occupation that follows, you know, it's not a conflict that's directly correlated with a large deployment of mercenaries. Although the Soviets do, you know, fight with communist Afghan forces or a significant part of that conflict. I think when we look at the Russians, sort of a more indicative example of how they've organized themselves is in Ukraine, where we've seen for quite some time their reliance on the Wagner Group before Prigozhin's run on Moscow that led to his
a former chef who became what is head of secret service and then a mercenary leader.
That's right. And then we also see in Russia their use of convicts. So opening up the prisons and offering clemency for military service. So, you know, it's important to say, you know, ask the question, which is a somewhat obvious question, is, you know, why does Putin decide to rely on the Wagner Group, or why does he choose to decide to rely on convict soldiers as opposed to just, you know, ordering a general mobilization of the Russian population? And the reason is because, politically speaking, I mean, you know, he wants to insulate himself from the political costs of war. If every well-to-do Russian family was being forced to send their eldest child to the front line to die in Ukraine, it would become politically more costly for him to prosecute that war. So all leaders do this. All nations do this. You know, we in the United States have done it. Is you if you're prosecuting a war, you want to keep the political costs low. I think just what's important as a citizenry, that we be aware of the construct, you know, that we understand that, okay, when our, you know, when our president says everybody go shopping and our professional military is going to fight this war after 9/11 and there'll be no war taxes because we're just going to all put it on the national deficit, that we as citizens just be aware, well, the reason the war is being prosecuted that way is to keep the political costs low and to give our political leaders the ability to wage war on a very long tether. And I think, you know, we should ask real questions. If a politician is trying to insulate themselves from the costs of war, is this a war that's worth fighting? Or is it the type of war that's going to become a quagmire and not be worth fighting? And I think, you know, that's often been the case in these types of conflicts where we give our politicians too long of a leash. We look up and, you know, 5, 10, 15, in the case of Afghanistan, 20 years pass, and we wonder why we're all still fighting.
Yeah, I found the analysis of Ukraine and Putin in the piece particularly interesting. Are there models of mercenary troops and mercenary models that work, that are successful. I'm not sure if you brought this up in the piece, but of course, the American War of Independence was fought between indigenous Americans, or I guess settler Americans, and many mercenary troops employed by the British. Are there examples of mercenary troops who were really fearsome, who won wars successfully and endlessly?
Sure. Well, I mean, the issue with mercenaries is not that they aren't fearsome or an effective fighting force. I mean, many of the greatest and most effective fighting forces in the history of warfare have been mercenary troops. It's more how mercenary armies can ultimately become corrosive to the nations that they serve or the empires that they serve. So I think the Roman example is a great one. For instance, when Julius Caesar crosses the Rubicon and becomes the first emperor of Rome, taking Rome from the Republican period into the Imperial period, one of his first degrees is to allow foreign-born, non-native-born Romans to serve in the legions. And that policy extends out for hundreds of years. It's another 400 years until Rome falls. So I think one could argue that, an empire that lasts 1,000 years and 400 years of that, you're using mercenaries and they're effective, that, you know, they've succeeded, even if at the end of the day, they're what contribute to the fall of the empire. So I think that when we talk about the outsourcing of war or the use of mercenaries, oftentimes it can be very effective, particularly in the short and the medium term. However, it seems to consistently be long-term corrosive to the civic health of a society.
The Iranians sent drones over, which were easily shot down by the Israelis and the Americans. Can AI change this? I mean, will AI in some ways replace mercenaries, particularly as we get robots fighting in war?
Well, I think artificial intelligence is going to, change the nature of war in some very, very profound ways. But I also think that war will also remain the same in some very essential ways. You know, the 19th century military theorist Karl von Clausewitz, who wrote the seminal tract on war, and he witnessed much of the Napoleonic Wars. He said the nature of war is slaughter, and that actually never changes. Fundamentally, that is what war is about. It's what it always will be about, no matter what technology gets introduced onto the battlefield. But that being said, technology can change the way that war feels. So I think, you know, when you're talking about war, there's always this sort of tension between the new and the old. I traveled to Ukraine. I've been there a number of times since the war broke out. And the one thing that's always striking to me is how that war in particular is this juxtaposition of the new drone technologies, electromagnetic warfare, I mean, you name it, along with trench warfare that looks like it's something out of the early 1900s. So I think that AI will certainly change the nature of warfare. I don't think it will reduce the need for armies to exist and standing armies to take the field. And as long as we need standing armies to take the field, you're going to need soldiers. And as long as you need soldiers, you're going to have to figure out where you're going to source them from. And there'll probably be a need for outsourcing, or people will feel the desire to outsource. And then you get into this idea of mercenaries.
Since I got you, Elliot, and you've spent some time in Ukraine, what's your take on the current military situation there? It seems as if a lot of the news now is rather dire from the Ukrainian point of view.
I think this supplemental spending package is absolutely essential for the Ukrainians. You know, I remain optimistic that it will pass. And then I think really the next question becomes, it comes at the ballot box. And I'm sure the Russians are sitting back and they want to see what's going to happen in the U.S. presidential elections, as well as several elections that are going to occur around Europe this year. And I think it's important to always keep in mind that war is a political action, and that many of these wars are not decided on the battlefield. They are, in fact, decided at the ballot box. But I think we're going to have a lot more clarity on the political situation, both in the United States and, most importantly, in Europe as we head into the new year. And I think that's probably a moment where you might see some movement on the battlefield, and you might also see some political movement that could, who knows, perhaps result in negotiation or some break in the stalemate that seems to exist up to this moment. But we're going to have to see.
We certainly are in terms of politics. Does the increasing student unrest over his American support for Israel, does that remind you of the 60s? Are we returning to Vietnam in a sense with U.S. support for Israel?
Not really. I mean, you know, listen, the 60s, kids were getting drafted. So the protests in the 1960s were, I think, much more visceral because the participants of the protest were being called to go serve in Vietnam and possibly die there. I think what you're seeing happen in the U.S. Today in these protests are of a different sort. You know, we'll see the impact that they have domestically on President Biden. If there's a Trump administration, I think they'll have a little to no impact because that's not Trump's base. You know, so we'll see.
Final question, Elliot. You're an unusual fellow. You went to Tufts. You're from an upper middle class family. You've traveled around, and yet you joined the military. And in that sense, you're very different from your generation, certainly your class generation. You talk about mercenaries in terms of outsourcing military muscle. But could one argue, in a sense, that the history, the military history of America over the last 50 years has been to outsource its working class, its lower classes mostly, and that the Elliot Ackermans of the world are far and few between. And for the most part, American overseas war are fought by people without a great deal of political, cultural, or economic clout. And in that sense, having a military of that type is as dangerous as having mercenary armies?
Well, I think that I certainly agree with the notion that if you look at the last 50 years, the U.S., you know, particularly, you know, in the name of corporate interests, has outsourced its labor overseas, and the consequences have been very dire for the American middle class. The idea that we would just transition and become a technologically as opposed to an industrially based economy kind of turned into a fallacy, and all we really have is an ever widening gap between the haves and the have-nots in the U.S. And I think when we look at what the military has been in the history of this country, and particularly when there was, you know, when we had a large standing military and national public service and a draft, was the military served as a great tool of social mobilization. I mean, anyone who serves in the military, if you do a 4-year enlistment, you get a GI Bill that will pay for your college and, you know, launch you sort of into the professional class. So it's been a great tool of social mobilization, but it also been a great tool of great societal leveler. It forced everybody from all backgrounds, geographically, economically, to serve. And that made the fabric of this country look very, very different than it does now, where we are far more fragmented and we know one another far less. And so I think we've lost a great deal by not having this type of national service and outsourcing our military service. And I would agree with your contention that we've also lost a great deal by outsourcing our industrial capacity and the ability of the United States to make things.
So you would like to see the return of national service, not necessarily the draft, where all young people spend a year or two of their lives working on behalf of the U.S. government or military?
No, I've argued this, and if you read the Fifth Act, I write about it quite extensively in the Fifth Act. But I'm very much for a draft in the United States. I think that, first of all, if you look at the history of the draft, it's never been, even in Vietnam, where, you know, every single young person in the United States had to serve. The drafts have always been done on a lottery system. So maybe, you know, one in every 10 young people would have to serve. And it depends. It's, you know, you can scale it to how much of the military you believe should be conscripted versus how much should be volunteer. But to me, it's less the draft that changes the fabric of society, although obviously it does. But the thing that's the most profound is the specter of the draft. It's that every American family would know that when their son or daughter, because women now serve unrestricted throughout the U.S. military, would come of age, they would have a 1 in 10, a 1 in 20, even a 1 in 50 chance of having to serve for 2 years. And I think in this country, we would be having very, very different conversations around issues of war and peace if the specter of the draft existed. And I think it would be it would have a very positive and sobering effect as we discuss international issues.
And that would have a more sobering and powerful effect on young people or parents or both?
Both.